This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Wow. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, and in particular to this event, What a Treat, Blue Planet 2, and Mark is the series producer.
Correct.
Hello, and everyone. Co-author.
Yes.
Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful.
Big team effort.
I'm sure.
Yep.
So when somebody first sat down and said, let's make Blue Planet again, given that it was such an iconic series the first time round, wasn't that quite a scary moment in terms of being able to meet or exceed what had already been achieved in 2001?
Very much so. When the original series came out, it was seminal, it was groundbreaking, and much celebrated. In fact, it inspired a whole generation of marine biologists, and to be tasked with a new generation, with a new challenge of making Blue Planet 2, came with a huge baggage, an expectation. It was also a privilege, a great privilege. And we, 25 of us, a core team of 25 of us, dedicated 4 years of our life. And one thing that united us all, in fact, we had an extended team of over 1,000 people, was this passion to make a series that we thought could make a difference and that would inspire a new generation. So it was a massive undertaking, and not without its headaches.
So on day one, when you've decided, right, we're going to go ahead and do this, how do you even start to map the series out in terms of finding the stories and the characters and so on?
So it's a four-year project, and we could spend almost a year trawling the world, talking to an international community of scientists to try and find those never told before stories. And the whole kind of premise of the series was newness. We've got to take the audience on a magical adventure into new worlds, meet new creatures, and show astonishing never told before behaviors. And we could not have done this series without the help of the scientific community. And so for a whole year, we would go to conferences and meet up with various scientists. But equally, we had such a vast sort of network of contacts. We heard a story through a friend of a friend of a friend of a fisherman who had seen these huge fish leap out of the water and capture birds in midair. And we heard there was a South African fisherman. And we eventually tracked him down. And it wasn't a story based out of South Africa. In fact, it was a story based out of the Seychelles in the Indian Ocean. And in fact, it was these massive reef fish, giant trevally, that had been seen by fly fishermen who were actually fishing for these giant trevally, leaping out of the air, catching sooty terns in midair. And so whereas 99% of the time, we would always be working with scientists, there were occasions like this where we rolled the dice and said, actually, that's a prize. There was no scientific documentation, not even a photograph. But we decided that it was worth pursuing. And sure enough, I don't know if you've seen Program 1, there's these huge fish that leap out of the water. It's quite breathtaking.
Have people seen that? It stays with you, doesn't it?
So it's those calculated risks. And in fact, that took 2 years to film. And it's his own story.
And are you quite a feisty bunch? I mean, I can imagine that once you've tracked that down, you're quite emotional, or whoever found that is quite emotional about that story definitely getting in the final series. Is there quite a lot of elbowing and that's definitely going in and some things have to get dropped?
Very little is dropped. I mean, everything is so hard fought, and we are very calculated and targeted as to what stories we will try and pursue, because sometimes it may take three attempts, like the killer whales in Norway feeding on the herring bait balls. That happened actually over three consecutive winters. So once you commit to it, you've got to have sort of tunnel vision, say, right, we believe that it's worth pursuing, and that within the set budget, it's achievable. And see it through.
You touched there on the importance of scientists, and that's one thing that has changed between the original Blue Planet and Blue Planet 2 in terms of how much more of a profile you've given the scientists that you work with, hasn't it?
I suppose the oceans are the place today to explore in terms of, for us, in terms of making wildlife films. There are so many new stories out there. But it's the scientists who hold the key to showing us and revealing these remarkable things. So, in fact, we've got a clip just to showcase one of the wonderful scientists we work with, a young guy called Alex Vail. He grew up on Lizard's Island off the Great Barrier Reef. And he got to befriend an individual tusfish. And this is just a bit of behind the scenes to introduce you to Alex.
I've been diving on the reef out here for 21 years now, actually, since I was 8 years old. So a fair while, and then snorkeling for quite a while before that. I've always absolutely loved fish. When I was little, they were just something amazingly pretty to look at, but I didn't really understand that much about them, about their behaviour or anything like that. But now through studying them, I found out that there's way more going on in their heads than we ever thought. And they're really complex animals, and there's actually a fair bit of intelligence in there. Fish have definitely got personalities. Like, you'll get individuals that are just polar opposites from each other, and this is within the same species. So, you know, out on the reef, you'll get one that's really curious, one that's really shy of you. So it's quite nice. You can definitely get to know individuals. The first time I saw the tusfish cracking a clam open on its little anvil, I was just gobsmacked. Like, I've been looking at this reef for well over 20 years, and I'd never seen it before. Seeing it carrying around what to us would be like a golf ball-sized clam in its mouth, it's just absolutely ridiculous. It's amazing. So the tusfish have got these, you know, big snaggly teeth poking out the front there, which are, you know, not that attractive, but they're perfect for picking up little clams. So, you know, he picks up the little clam, takes it back to his little castle where there's one little spot where he whacks it on there, whacks it back and forth a few times, sometimes it flies out, and then eventually, after 20 or so cracks, he'll get it open and Bob's your uncle.
What I want you to see this is a good demonstration of the ambition of the series, because it's an example of tool use in a fish. And our challenge was to make people fall in love with the oceans, make them fall in love with the individual characters. And the thing about fish is that usually we kind of perceive them as a bit alien and maybe a bit dumb. And what you see there is an example of tool use, and tool use is a behaviour you usually associate with chimpanzees, corvids, that kind of thing. And so what we were trying to do was redefine our people's attitudes towards fish and show that they actually are incredibly intelligent. And that took Alex 6 weeks to film with our team. And he befriended an individual tusfish, and he'd follow it day after day after day, got to know it, it accepted him into its world. And then our camera teams, diving on rebreathers, and those of you who are divers will maybe be familiar with this technology. Unlike scuba, you re-sug your exhaled air, so you can dive for 4.5 hours at a time without releasing bubbles, so you dive in silence. And it makes a massive difference in terms of how close you can get to your subjects. So we were able to sneak right up to Percy the tusfish. Percy, coined by Alex because of his nickname, Percy the Persistent. It could take up to 50 goes to smash open a clam. And it just enabled us to meet this individual, follow him day after day after day, and eventually film all the different angles to get that one sequence together.
The other thing that's developed in wildlife television more generally, and I'm thinking, you know, Winter Watch, Autumn Watch as well, is this idea of storytelling. That, you know, I find it really interesting that you call that fish a character.
Yeah.
But how important is that in terms of engaging an audience?
Well, we often get accused of being anthropomorphic with our subjects. We're not, actually. We're trying to be true to science. But we want to if you look at a Pixar film and you look at the angles and the shots they choose, where you see big eyes, also two eyes front facing, there's a lot of visual language that filmmakers, particularly in animation, use to make you fall in love with Nemo or whatever the story is. And so we want to emulate that and just really get you, the audience, to see them at the world from their perspective. And that's why we built special lenses with wide-angle miniature lenses to get you right into their world. In terms of storyboarding, it's a great discipline. Once you know what is possible through the scientists, then if you storyboard it, you are as directors, disciplined in what you're trying to achieve visually, and what lenses and camera equipment you then design to enable that, to realize that. And so you go with your best intentions into the film with your storyboard. Of course, when you're there, nothing is ever as you thought it would be. And you have to think on your feet, redesign what you were trying to achieve. For example, when we filmed the Bobbit worm, which is this grotesque giant polychaete worm that lives in Indonesia, and it comes out at night and grabs unsuspecting passing fish and pulls them under. It's a real kind of macabre story, and then injects them with venom. When we tried to film that with white light, the Bobbit worm wasn't having it and would shy away from us. So we had to redesign in the field an infrared rig to be able to film it with infrared light that we can't see, it can't see. And so it would get on with its behavior and so forth. So you have to be very reactive in the field. And in fact, at the beginning of each episode, we will have a complete narrative arc with the 10, 12 stories. Of course, you go out there. When we went to film the boiling sea off Costa Rica, the first time we went to Australia, and because of El Nino, we didn't know this, of course, not a single lanternfish, deep sea fish, came up to the surface to spawn that year. Therefore, no tuna, no sharks, no boiling sea. And we came back with nothing. In fact, 18 months later, El Nino switched off. We were able to then film it on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, off Costa Rica. But it's an example of how the luxury of Hollywood, not saying it's easy making Hollywood films, is that once they've got their script, they can follow that slavishly. We have our script, and then nothing goes to plan. And you have to rethink, rejuggle, always react, bin old stories, come up with new ones, etc.
You have an advantage in this series compared to the last one and others that have gone before, in terms of the technology that you've got and that you're able to develop, don't you? Tell us about the things, the fantastic cameras that you've been able to develop to enable us to see what's on the film.
Well, we wanted to not only tell new stories, but give a fresh visualization of the oceans. And to do that, we built a lot of new cameras, lenses, from 24-inch dome lenses that will give you an in-focus a shot both above and beneath the water surface, like the so that you can see the baby walrus and the mother on top of the iceberg and see in focus beneath it. These straight scopes, which I just touched on earlier, which are these miniaturized wide-angle lenses. The advent of these low-light cameras, they're so sensitive, these camera chips now, that actually during the course of the filming, there's a sequence we could only film at the very end when the technology was sufficient to be able to record in pitch darkness so that we could see mobular rays come in. This is in program one, come in to these great clouds of plankton that are bioluminescent, and as they disturb them, they would phosphoresce. That was only possible in the third year of filming because the low light camera set technology was only then that advanced.
And was that something that you got involved in terms of saying, we're doing this, can someone help us develop it?
No, we can't take any credit for that.
No,
that was just Canon had, at that stage, developed this incredible system. But what we did do, we collaborated with scientists and we built miniaturized cameras that we placed in what we called sucker cams. And what's wonderful about them is that they have 8 other sensors that enabled the scientists to record also invaluable information from acoustics, acceleration, depth. And so by collaborating with scientists, we were able to attach these sucker cams onto the backs of whales and sharks and give the audience a fresh experience. They could ride off the back of these giants into the heart of the action. And so we've got a clip here just to show you one of the examples of when we tried to use sucker cams, in this case, with sperm whales.
Tag on!
I spent thousands of hours with these whales and hundreds of hours with this family, but I've never seen the world the way they have. Well, it's a part of the world that we don't get to see very often, whether it's the sperm whale part or not. The ocean is very hard for us to explore, so to see what a whale sees is going to be very exciting. Went off on fingers, which is fantastic. She has a new calf now named Digit. This unit is the group of seven. We've spent hundreds of hours with them, thousands probably. They're the most well-studied family of sperm whales in the world. There have been cameras that have gone out on sperm whales before. I haven't seen a lot of the footage or know how successful they are. But this is the first time that a camera tag has gone out on an animal that we know by name, that we know their family history, and the social relationships of the other animals that hopefully we'll get to see on camera. It's amazing every time we do this. We stuck this on the back of a whale. It rode around for about 30 hours seeing everything that she saw. It popped off and signaled us where to go. And we found something the size of a shoe. And now we get to bring it home and see what it saw.
Well, Shane, this is what we've got back from the sea.
It's very exciting.
A little dog called Fido. But what we don't know is what's inside.
The tension is palpable.
Is it dry?
I think so, yeah.
That's good. That means the tube held.
Okay, back. No. This is going to be the most exciting part. Holy shit. Okay, all right. She's right above.
Well, I mean, we've never had this perspective of what life as a sperm whale is before, ever.
I mean, absolutely fantastic for us to see, but those scientists must love you, don't they?
Well, it's a very much a mutual, beneficial relationship.
It's real symbiosis.
Yeah. Now, we may seem overexcitable bunch, but that took months to design. It had to be pressure tested to withstand pressures down to over a kilometre. Huge amount of R&D, and then just getting it on, take many weeks, and retrieving it. They're not always easy to find. There are a box of secrets, and it enabled us to see groundbreaking things, and that's part of the endeavour.
We need to talk about the legend that is David Attenborough.
Right.
Obviously we saw him do pieces to camera here and there. Yeah. How much of the filming was he there for?
So, David is perhaps the sort of the pinnacle of wildlife presenting. He's the real deal. He's been at it for 50 years. He is the voice of authority. He's a household name. And it's always an absolute privilege to work with David. As he says, he does the words. So we will make the films. And he will then will write a scratch com, and then he will. We'll write a loose narration,
okay.
And then David will put it in his own words. But he did much more than that. He was on location. He introduced the series. And he was heavily involved and authored the final episode that looks at the future of the world's oceans, which he feels very passionate about. And so he was on location multiple times for that. My lasting memory on location with David was I was directing him on the bow of the boat for the opening piece to camera. And we got what we wanted, and it was time to take a bit of a break. It was pretty hot out there in the tropical sunshine. And there's two ways down to get to the lower decks to the galley. One is down this nice cylindrical staircase. That's what normal people would go down. Or there was this sort of fireman's lift vertical ladder. And I just had to have a quick word with the skipper. I turned around, and I saw David disappear down this vertical ladder at the age of 90. I was thinking, holy crap, what have we done? Have we lost David? The nation will never forgive me. Anyway, sure enough, I scrambled down the cylindrical staircase, and there he was, having his lunch, saying, well, what kept you? And that sums up David. He's fit, tenacious, insatiably curious, and passionate about what he does. So we could not make these series without him.
Hugely passionate. And I wonder how much of a crusade, really, it either was in terms of planning or became as the series developed. I mean, I'm particularly thinking about the issue of plastics.
Yeah. We never set out to make an environmental series. This series was to celebrate the majesty of the oceans, to introduce the world to to the wonders of that had never been seen before, tell astonishing new stories, show the complexity of life and sophistication of life in the oceans. But we could not, during the course of making it, report on what we saw. And, for instance, when we filmed Percy the Tuskfish, the Great Barrier Reef underwent two of the biggest bleaching events in history, coral bleaching events. And what we wanted to show was a contemporary portrait of the world's oceans and be truthful. And so we had to include, particularly in our final episode, these issues from plastics to noise pollution to global warming. But what has been amazing is that although there are a lot of these fantastic organizations out there campaigning on behalf of plastics, Blue Planet 2 seems to have catalyzed particularly the plastic story. And every day in the papers, we read something new, whether it's Ryanair pledging to give up single-use plastics on their services or installing water fountains or giving President Xi in China a copy of Blue Planet 2, which I was particularly chuffed about. That happened earlier this week. That was Theresa May. Thank you. It's exciting that people seem to be moved by this and want to take action.
And it's gone out all around the world, hasn't it? How many people do you reckon have seen Blue Planet 2?
It hasn't gone out in every territory yet, but China alone, the figures so far are 225 million. Which is pretty astonishing. In the UK, Programme 1 was seen by, on aggregate, so that's the repeat and iPlayer plus 7, 20 million people, which beats Strictly and British Bake Off. It was our highest rated show of the year, which is quite extraordinary for a documentary series.
Fantastic.
So it's amazing.
Yeah. Let's talk some more about the technology and dive down into the deeps, and particularly the submarines.
Well, we just wanted to highlight the deep episode, the endeavour that went into that. We spent over 1,000 hours in the deep ocean, and we worked with incredible, brave and talented scientists. The producer was Orla Doherty. He's an incredibly enigmatic and talented producer. But they would dive day after day, week after week, in a tiny sphere, often going down to a kilometre deep, for 10 hours at a time. And they went slowly mad. So we just thought we'd show this little clip. It's quite funny.
This is Orla Doherty, possibly the most patient producer-director I've ever worked with, and together we spent almost 500 hours in this tiny bubble behind us.
This is Gavin Thurston, top wildlife cameraman. I've had the privilege of working with him for weeks on end, giving him chocolate to keep him happy. The worst thing about it is when we're in front of something absolutely incredible, knowing that we're only going to be with it for about 10 minutes and missing the moment because the sub moves or the current drifts us or whatever it is, and we knowing that we'll never ever see that animal, that landscape again.
This wasn't meant to be our day.
I don't think this dive has really worked.
The problems have been endless. Camera's not working, light's not working. Finding you get down to 900 meters, like sort of record-breaking depths beneath the ocean, three of you in that tiny sub to find out you've only got two sandwich boxes.
Diving here, well, there was concern about seals.
That's not Arctic seal or Antarctic seals. We're talking about the O-rings that actually stop water coming into the submarine.
And Ralph said, oh, look, you just keep an eye on that hatch and make sure it's not leaking. And I honestly thought he was joking, but he wasn't. The highlight for me has been seeing animals that we believe are surface animals that live in the top layer of the ocean and encountering them at phenomenal depths, like swordfish coming straight at us at 700 meters. And yes, there was screaming. Just getting a whole new insight into how deep these animals work, that how their world is so much bigger than we ever imagined. That's been incredible.
Occasionally, all are swapped out and let the scientists come into the deep. And I would say to the scientists, you see that thing there? We've been seeing a lot of those. What's that? And the scientist goes, I have no bloody idea. And it's fantastic to think there are things 800 meters beneath our feet now, are things that nobody's seen before, that we don't even know what they are.
Is that the main job of a producer, to keep the cameraman in chocolate?
Pretty much. Yeah, you don't want a grumpy cameraman. You've got to keep them fed. But I think what's particularly exciting is that, for instance, we were the first people in history to dive in a manned submersible in Antarctica. And you've got to think of all the amazing achievements that we've done in terms of scientific exploration. And that's quite extraordinary. And to be down there day after day and film it with 4K cameras, we can bring that to the audience, and it's very, very exciting.
I mean, there is a lot of bad news about the ocean and the environment and the plastics and whatever, but there have been some... Your series has been peppered with success stories as well, hasn't it? And I think that's been quite important in terms of people feeling like, OK, it's not all bad.
Sure. I mean, quoting Dr. Sylvia Earle, who's perhaps the most eminent marine biologist out of America, I mean, she will always say you have to give hope stories, and if you don't provide a hope, everyone just gives up. They think, well, there's nothing I can do about it. And we met inspiring scientists and individuals like, for instance, Len Peters, who's just been awarded a Commonwealth Award based out of Trinidad, who made it a personal crusade to change attitudes and protect leatherback turtles, our largest turtles. He persuaded people not to kill them for bushmeat, but to actually use them as a resource for tourism, and they have an economic value. And as a result, their beach is now a success story, and they have huge numbers of nesting leatherbacks. So there are some really positive stories like that, aren't there?
Was it that story where David Attenborough was sort of in amongst the turtles?
Yeah,
which was very much for me the gorilla, that kind of iconic shot of the gorillas. Was that deliberate?
Yeah, it was. We wanted to show that David. I mean, that was a scene that perhaps was reminiscent of life on Earth 20, 30 years ago. And the wonderful thing about David is that even at 90 and two titanium knees later, he can lie down. He can stride out. He can do all these things, and he still gets a massive thrill being. Having these incredible encounters. Mm.
The other success story was sea otters.
Sea otters, yeah. They bounced back after centuries of persecution for their fur, but they're returning in good numbers. I mean, they're not out of the woods yet. There's all sorts of other issues going on from various diseases from cat poo, you don't want to know about that, to great whites and killer whales off the northwest who are running out of salmon and other fish and are turning to snacking on sea otters. So it's always a complicated story, but at least the pressure from hunting is over.
If people are thinking, younger people perhaps in the audience, or perhaps people who are older and have got friends and family who are interested in a career in wildlife, either as a cameraman or a producer or as a director, what's been your route in, and who are the sorts of routes that you're seeing coming through now?
First of all, you've got to be absolutely passionate because there's lots of competition. But one of the things is now we've got iPhones and other Android phones. It means you can make a little film on mating slugs in your back garden. I mean, you don't have to be out in the wilds of Africa to demonstrate an enthusiasm for storytelling and telling stories from the natural world. Whether it's a beetle or a slug, you can film it, you can document it. And there are all sorts of brilliant courses out there now, masters at UWE and other universities. I mean, I've got a biology degree, which is quite a normal way in. You start at the research level where you're talking to scientists and help find these stories. But there's no set route. If you're interested in your subject, interested in photography, interested in journalism, telling stories, that then if you've got the drive, ambition and mindset, the world's your oyster.
Just it. Let's open the floor to questions. Stick your hand up if you've got a question. We've got a couple of microphones here. There's a question just there. Have we got anybody here that we can come to next? Okay, you go first and then we'll come to you in a second. Yeah. Hold it close and just speak in.
Right. It's still not working.
Yes,
is it working? It is, right. What surprised you most from what you were expecting when you started out to what you got actually when you were at the end of the filming? What was the biggest surprise?
I think it's stories like the decorating octopus. So off the coast of South Africa, a amateur naturalist, Craig Foster, every day would go out for a swim in the kelp forests, ignoring the sharks. And he came across the common octopus, which is the same one we get off our coast here. And he saw behaviours that he just couldn't believe. When these octopus, if you saw the episode on the Green Seas, when these octopuses are harassed by sharks, one of their tricks is to decorate themselves in a suit of armour made up of shells. And the sharks seem to be confused and they can't get at the octopus. And then the octopus makes its escape. And I think it's just showing that there are levels of intelligence and complexity and sophistication in your common and garden octopus. That's what, for me, was so surprising. And if that's happening in the octopus, what else is going out there? Now, only 10% of the oceans has been explored. There's a whole another 90% of think of the stories out there. I know there's a squid called the colossal squid. No one's ever filmed that before. It's even bigger than the giant squid. It lives in Antarctica. Imagine we could go and film that.
Thank you. There's a question just over here. Yes.
After such a wonderful 4 years filming this and creating so much for us, what do you do next?
Right. It's, we're just taking a breath. there was a 17-year gap between this episode of Blue Planet and of course, the original. I don't think it'll be a 17-year gap for the next one, but we still need a bit of time to find not just the new stories, but for technology to go on to another level. Because I don't think you, as the audience, will forgive us if we just sort of showed the same thing twice. So we have to keep raising the bar. So we need technology to improve and those new stories to come through. But for instance, I know that Woods Hole in America have built underwater drones that will follow a pinger. So if you could put the pinger, and they've done this already to demonstrate it, you could put a pinger on the back of a great white, and this drone that has a whole kind of plethora of cameras on them, mounted on them, this underwater torpedo literally follows the shark. Now, that's a prototype, but as that improves, imagine what we're going to get to see.
Do teams who work on land, in the sea, on planets, human planet,
yeah.
Do they mix, or are you all quite sort of set in what you do?
No, we all mix.
Right.
for something like oceans, as you imagine, you need specific skills, and so you, whether it's, you have to have an understanding of the oceans to be able to not only be safe, you have to understand the sea, understand boats, understand diving, but equally you need to understand what you're trying to achieve and the risks you're taking to make those stories. So that's quite niche, but if it's on land, I mean that's the thing about wildlife filmmaking. It's a niche area in itself, but then you could become an expert in macro photography, doing insect series, to canopy films, to frozen Antarctic filming. So, but on the whole, yes, we do sort of mix around.
Okay. Other questions? There's a question down here, and then we'll come to you in a second. Oh, okay. 1, 2, 3. Yes.
Close. Yeah. Just thinking about the plastic problem, was what we saw on the series and in the book exactly how you came across it?
Mm-hmm. So what we saw on TV, was that how it was out there in the wild in terms of plastic?
Yes. Wherever we went, whether it was to film a clownfish in Borneo, into the deep, onto a sub-Antarctic island with albatross, we came across plastic. It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's just one of the realities of... I don't know quite what you mean by that, but we didn't put it like this. Yes, I mean, it's how it was. Yeah, yeah.
And one of the scientists says it's up to us to do...
Sorry, for instance, just to give you an example of the kind of reality of this, when we filmed David's piece to camera, we were on a beach in Florida, and it was strewn in plastics. We didn't have to come up with a bin load ourselves. It was all there, sadly. Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a big problem.
Thank you. Yes, question over here.
Hi, can you tell us about the one that got away, the shot or the sequence that you really wanted to capture, but for whatever reason didn't happen? And will you go back out and make it happen if you can?
You want to know how much the license fee we wasted? Yes, there were ones that got away. And that, if you didn't have a few mishaps, it means you didn't raise the bar enough in your ambition. But I think the boiling sea is a good example of how we tried something. It got scuppered because of El Nino. But 18 months later... the conditions improved on admittedly on a different part of the ocean, and we were able to reattempt that story. But we have to be so meticulous in what we target, because we haven't got the budgets to waste. So although we are ambitious, we're also very targeted. So actually, what more than likely would be that we would go somewhere, didn't quite get it the way we wanted to, so we'd have to go back again. Hence having to return to Norway 3 times to film the herring bait balls.
Thank you. There's a question down here.
My question was actually very similar, and I was wondering if there were any projects that you had to completely abandon because of the technology, but you're hoping to come back to them in the future.
Similar to it. So the mobular arrays that you see in the first episode, the bioluminesce, we tried that 2 years before, and the camera sensitivity just didn't enable us to get it crisply and in the majesty that we'd hoped. We had to wait 2 years for the camera technology to improve sufficiently to be able to return there and get it in all its glory. So we had to play catch up with technology in that example.
Other questions? Any other hands going? Have you got anybody? Yes, question over there.
Out of all the wonderful things we've heard about, what was your absolute favourite moment from the whole series? Or is that too difficult to answer?
I'm so proud of so many of the stories, from the tusfish to the big bait balls, where we managed to give the audience a fresh perspective with these sucker cams. But I think for instance, the Giant Trevally, I think that's a good example of really pushing the boundary because there was no scientific validation, backup, and it was really a fisherman's tale, and we had to go on a few very scant accounts to the back of beyond, and it was expensive. We had to charter a little plane to get there and really rolled the dice on that one. And although we didn't get in the first year to the degree that we wanted, so we had to go back a following year, despite the fact a hurricane had passed through, flattened the island, and there was a tick infestation, which impacted the birds and the breeding success. But we managed to get it with these super slow-mo cameras the following year. And so, I mean, there's just so much that because of this incredible team we work with that we were able to achieve.
We've talked quite a lot about the pictures and how you capture those, but sound is something that, again, jumped out. How much has that technology changed, and what sort of difference did it make to the overall series and effect?
So the wonderful thing about, for instance, these sucker cams is, and that clip you saw with the sperm whales, it also had an acoustic recorder. And so in sync with the pictures, you were able to then capture groundbreaking new sounds from the moment that the sperm whales switch from talking to each other, which is its communication clicks, to echolocatory clicks when it then goes into hunting mode.
What's echolocatory?
So it's when it uses its sonar, like a bat, to fire out sound, get a refracted sound back, and be able to compute objects, in other words, see with sound, and such that it would increase its frequency rate to the point where you knew it was hunting, and then it goes silent. You know it's made its hit, its kill. So we also use scientific recordings from underwater hydrophones with four receivers, which enable you to pinpoint the source of sound. So we really never appreciated how acoustically dynamic it was. For instance, on coral reefs, they have their own dawn chorus, like we do in our temperate woodlands, when all the fish wake up and start chatting. So it's a really quite noisy world down there.
Which we wouldn't have thought of. And we're going to finish with a clip, and a very special clip, because it's never before been seen in public. But before we do that, let's just say that Mark will be over at the Stanford's bookshop just there, signing and chatting some more and talking and whatever. It's an absolutely beautiful book. If you think the series was good, take a look at the book, please. But just talk us into this final clip.
This is a bit of fun. Not for me, but I like to laugh at our poor teams. This is another clip from the submarine, when they went to film a whale carcass off the Azores, and they weren't expecting this response from the sharks. These are 6 meter long, six gill sharks. There were six of them. It's good alliteration. That all came down to this carcass. They may not have eaten for a year. We don't precisely know how long, but they were ravenous. And what we weren't expecting was how territorial they would be and how they would then regard the submarine as a competitor.
And enormous six gill sharks. We estimate them about 6 meters long. Over.
Okay, copy that.
Oh,
my God.
Look at the size.
They're huge. I've never seen anything like this. This is unbelievable.
this one. Absolutely.
Oh.
God. Oh. Look at this on the left. Oh, God.
Bigger.
Oh.
Did you see this? I went backwards and was pushing us to the front. The submarine is very strong, but they're so big, strong, that I'm a little bit afraid. Oh. Move, move away. Go!
Fantastic. Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for being here and for sharing the stories and the footage. Absolutely wonderful. Mark Brownlow.
Right. Thank you.
Great.